When you cry out to God instinctively, what is it that you want? What is it that you want God to do? What is it that you want God to give you? I'm asking this because the story we come to this morning, it's a story about 10 men who cried out to God. And initially, on the surface of the story, you would think these 10 men are crying out to God for the same reason. They share a problem, and they're all crying out together. But Jesus will show us that as the story develops, you see that one of the 10 is crying out for a different reason. He wants something different. He wants something more than what the other 9 men want from Jesus. And that you'll see in his life made all the difference in the world. So Luke chapter 17, we'll read verses 11 through 19. On the way to Jerusalem, he was passing along between Samaria and Galilee. And as he entered a village, he was met by 10 lepers who stood at a distance and lifted up their voices saying, "Jesus, Master, have mercy on us." And when he saw them, he said to them, "Go and show yourselves to the priests." And as they went, they were cleansed. Then one of them, when he saw that he was healed, turned back, praising God with a loud voice. And he fell on his face at Jesus' feet, giving him thanks. Now he was a Samaritan. Then Jesus answered, "Were not 10 cleansed? Where are the 9? Was no one found to return and give praise to God except this foreigner?" And he said to him, "Rise and go your way. Your faith has made you well." This is the word of the Lord. As Luke unfolds this story, I'm going to show you these 3 points. There's a pitiful condition, the background, the backdrop to the story, then a paradoxical command. What Jesus tells these men to do does not make any sense at all. And then we see this praiseworthy comeback where this one expresses something that the other 9 do not, and something grows out of that. So we begin with this pitiful condition. And of course, we're again talking about leprosy. If you've been with us for a period of time, as we go through the Gospels, there is this disease or this series of diseases that are under this catchphrase, leprosy. And in Jesus' day, it was not just Hansen's disease. It was a bunch of different things that the way this disease works physically is that you get these lesions and ulcers and sores all over your skin, and it causes you to lose feeling. And as you lose that feeling then and you stumble around your day, you're losing fingers and toes and noses and ears because you're hurting yourself, but you cannot sense that you're hurting yourself because you've lost feeling. Along with that physical disablement, that physical distortion, that almost dehumanized position that a leper's in, there of course comes an emotional stigma with that. Because there is distance placed between lepers and any other category of people. They're considered, in the Jewish law, they're considered ceremonially unclean, and that's because they're highly contagious. It's not as easy as they thought, but it is easy to pass on this disease from one person to another through physical contact or by touching things that someone with this disease had touched. And so there was a relational distance, a social distance that was placed between any person who was leprous and a person who was clean or a person who was innocent or undefiled. And these people would literally have to go around, and if they saw someone, they would have to go around and walk downwind of them by a distance of at least 10 feet. If for some reason they found themselves upwind of a clean person, they had to find some distance of hundreds of feet. And we understand that with this physical and social and emotional and psychological distance, this dehumanizing, there was also something spiritual that happened with these lepers. That because they were placed outside the worshiping community, because they were placed at a distance, they could not come to the temple, they could not come and do sacrifices. The worship of their hearts and their inclusion in a community of faith like this was impossible. Well, not the worship of their hearts, but you understand what I'm saying. They could worship from their hearts, but they could not belong to a community. And even in that culture, they were referred to as the walking dead, because it was only a matter of time before they physically died, but before that, they're bearing in their bodies a disease that has already, in essence, stolen their lives. And you see this pity reflected even in their own words when they see this master, they see this, and who knows what they thought of him. The word they use indicates they knew he had authority, but did they think he was the Son of God? Did they think he was the Messiah? We don't know. At this point, they're just saying, here is at least a faith healer of some kind, a traveling preacher who's been reported to do these things other places, and they cry out to him these two words. They say, have mercy. And that in itself is beautiful because they realize we have no right to make demands. The one thing we're asking for, the one thing we need is simply help on no basis of something we've done. We need your kindness that's undeserved. One commentator says this was a pathetic, lonely group of outcasts eking out a survival existence on the fringe of society. Their disease was incurable, their situation was hopeless, their lives were miserable. Jesus offered their only chance for deliverance. And I think today, if we try to think who in our society is like that, I had a hard time coming up with someone who, because of something in their body, they're that sequestered from the rest of society. But I did think, Marty and I recently watched this video from a Samaritan's Purse on the Ebola outbreak in 2014 in West Africa. And many of you remember seeing that on the news night after night after night. Like, West Africa is going to die because any of the slightest contact between human beings and the next person gets it. And they get these high fevers and these shakes and their bodies shut down and they die. And it's horrible. That compares to the way at least these lepers were viewed of, you know, if someone has that, even if it's your spouse, you just immediately seek distance and hope that you can survive. Pitiful condition. And the first application I want to make, because this story is a paradigm for us understanding Jesus. And that paradigm is that we need to see ourselves as broken and hopeless as lepers. That often in Scripture, Jesus is using the picture of physical leprosy as indicative of the way we are apart from Him. And it may not be that our skin doesn't lack feeling, it's that our hearts lack feeling. We don't sense in our hearts, we don't feel with our hearts what we ought to feel. And we're meant to see ourselves in this story as living with this kind of walking death, with our brokenness, with our hopelessness, that we would be very wise to day after day just cry out to Jesus and say, Jesus, I don't have any right to make demands of you, but I have this pitiful condition because of my sin and because of the sin of others against me, because of the world I live in. Life hurts. Have mercy. And we see with these 10 that when they cry out, have mercy, then we see this paradoxical command. And I don't know if you noticed this, like Jesus was not afraid of touching lepers. There are other stories where people with incurable sicknesses, he literally would go to them and touch them. And because we know he could just speak to something, there's a beauty in that he would say, okay, I'm willing to associate with you in your uncleanness. I'm willing to identify with you. And though you are unclean, it's a picture of the gospel, though you are unclean and I am clean, I will give you my cleanness in exchange for your uncleanness. I will become unclean for you so that you are healed. So you look at this, and Jesus does something totally different than what he typically did. You notice he doesn't heal them outright. He doesn't say, hey, be well, thanks for crying out to me. He says, go away and show yourself to the priest. And if you know the Old Testament ceremonial stuff and the law of God, Leviticus and some of that weird stuff in there. If someone had a disease that was thought to be leprous and they were cured, they could go and present themselves to the priest, and the priest would look at them and say, okay, we're going to sequester you for a couple weeks, we're going to watch you, and then you come back and present yourself again. And I think it was 8 days or something like that. And if you're clean still, we can declare you unclean, and you go from being unclean to clean. And I love what Jesus is doing here, because in part, he's saying, okay, these high priests who don't believe in me, and they know you guys, they know you're lepers, when you go and present yourselves as clean to these priests, they're going to have to acknowledge that something greater than them is at work here. But I want you to imagine being one of those lepers, and maybe even the disappointment of not getting your healing, but hearing Jesus say, go away. And Luke doesn't record any more of the conversation, but you could think, go away. Go away. Why not just heal us? And you understand that embodied in this command of Jesus, which is so extremely paradoxical, is like, wait, why would I leave the source of my healing? Well, because obviously Jesus is calling them to obey his command in faith. You go, and with each step you take further away from me, the identified source of your healing, you're getting closer to your actual healing by walking in faith. And you notice the way that Luke puts it here. He says, as they went, they were cleansed. And again, that's an important word when you think about the fact they were not just sick, they were not just diseased, they were unclean. And because Jesus healed their bodies, and instantly at some point along there, they're looking and they're like, wait a second, you got your nose back, you got your fingers back. Dude, look, it's easier to walk now. I got toes now, you know? And they're looking at each other and they're beginning to celebrate, and they realize as they went in faith that Jesus has begun to heal them, or maybe instantaneously healed them. And he uses that word as well, which is a reference to the physical. And I want to pause here and make this important application, because I think we could just blow right by this point, that very often in the Christian life, in my life, in your life, we are called to walk in the promise of Christ's command. We are called to walk in the promise of Christ's call. What I mean is, if you actually read the Bible and you read all these commands of Jesus, all these commands of God, I think a lot of those commands are counterintuitive. If you just read them and you don't read them through your Christian lens that you've had for however long some of you have been followers of Jesus, if you just read the naked command, like, leave everything and come follow me, you're like, I don't feel like that. Just as these guys, I'm sure, didn't feel like going away from Jesus. And it will seem like Jesus is commanding me to, or he's calling me to do something that makes no sense at all. Like, if I'm going to get this from God, I'm going to have to almost do the opposite of what he's saying to do, because that's the only way I can see that it would work. And my encouragement from this text is that you look for the promise and you hope in the promise even as you go about fulfilling the command. This is everywhere in Scripture. There's that verse, don't be weary in doing well. And if you stop right there, you're like, well, I'm tired. I am weary in doing well. I quit. But there's a promise attached, isn't there? Do not be weary in doing well, for in due season you will reap if you do not faint. Or how about this? Go into all the world and proclaim the gospel. And you could think, like, how in the world am I supposed to go to a dangerous place? How am I supposed to stay here and jeopardize friendships and relationships by proclaiming the good news of Jesus? That's weird. That's awkward. But there's a promise. Jesus says, behold, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. That as you go to minister, wherever you're ministering with your life, your vocation, your specific calling, he says, I'm with you always and forever. I was reading this morning on my phone, the devotional reading for today was in Isaiah 26 in part, and I read another one this morning. You see these everywhere. He says, you will keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on you because he trusts in you. Wait, I'm supposed to keep my mind fixed on you and trusting in you at all times? That's impossible. I can't do that. I let you down, God. I doubt you. I question you sometimes. I get anxious in my heart. But there's that attached promise. You will keep him in perfect peace. And I just want you to understand, if you focus on the commands of God and you strip away the context of the promise, you'll find things impossible, you'll find things hopeless, you'll find things hard, you'll find things frustrating. You'll just be looking at your performance and saying, why isn't this working out the way that I thought it was going to? But if you focus on the promise and the one who promised those things, it makes a huge difference, because you find the grace, you find the strength that you need in the promise. And I think as these men go and they're getting further and further away from Jesus, and I hope there was a conversation something like this when someone's starting to despair, like, the priest is a long way away. You know, we got to live way outside the village. And they're like, come on, man, what's the worst it could do? It's like Naaman, you know, go bathe in the filthy river. And as servant says to him, like, what's the worst that could happen? He told you to just dunk yourself in the filthy river. So maybe you don't get healing, but maybe you do. And the focus on the promise of God that's contained in that command is where we find the grace, where we find the strength, where we aren't just legalists performing the commands of Jesus, but we are driven by the gospel hope that Jesus is embedding in command after command after command, walking the promise of Christ's call. And then already to the final point of this short story, you see this praiseworthy comeback. And again, I want you to understand that this is a paradigm, that this is a true story as Luke tells it, but it's meant to be a paradigm for the nine went away and did not come back. The one did come back. Jesus told a story out of it. He raised it as a more general concern, like, hey, wait, didn't I heal 10? Where are the other nine? Where's their gratitude? And I use the word comeback here, by the way, as a double meaning. This one, it says he literally came back. But a comeback is also a response. And you see that his physical comeback was indicative of a heart turned toward Jesus. And when he comes to Jesus, you see this simultaneous thing that happens where vertically he is, it says he's praising God. It's a word that means glorifying. It's a word that means giving weight to what God has done in his life. He's saying, all glory and honor and praise belong to God because I was in this condition and now I'm in this condition because of the power of God at work in, and this is the other important part, in this man Jesus. And there's the horizontal. That as he's vertically praising God, he's recognizing it was Jesus, it was this man who mediated this power and this grace of God to me. And you see his response then toward Jesus, that as he's praising God, it says he's falling on his face, which is a Semitic, an Eastern sign of not just respect, but of worship. That I'm not just going to praise God generally, I am going to worship Jesus specifically. And it says he gave thanks. It's like a Eucharist. It's the interesting word there. And it's a word that refers to the giving of gratitude. And so in the story, we see this contrast between nine who are happy to run off with the gift and one who comes back with the gift. And that's got to be an interesting conversation, right, too? That the one is, you know, they're in this small commune of lepers. So these guys know each other. And they get healed, and what does that conversation look like? I mean, can you imagine? It's like, it's as he said, and nine of them, I mean, how does that conversation go down? Like, sweet, it's as he said, like, we've got this whole new life. We were the walking dead, and now we're alive, and we go show ourselves to the priest, and the picture I get here is that nine were just eager to take the gift from Jesus and get on with their lives. And one of them somehow said, you know, I'm not so eager to get on with my life. I want to go have a conversation with the one that healed me and say, thank you. I've got the rest of my life to get on with my life. I want to take the gift back to the giver and show him. By the way, I think that the nine, by the posture of their movement onward with life, they're indicating to us as the reader, they got what they really wanted, right? And what they really wanted was to be healed. What they really wanted to be was to be clean and to move on with their life as normal. They got what they wanted. And the one said, I thought I wanted that, but I see now in this moment that I want something more than the gift. I want the giver. So he takes the gift back and says, it is not enough for me, Jesus, that I have your gift and I use it to go live the life that I want. I want you, the giver, more than I want the gift. And worshiping Jesus was more important to him than getting on with his life. And by the way, I want you to see this link here that Jesus now raises as the paradigm, the example for all of us. It's a link between true faith and gratitude. Because Jesus is basically saying, man, if those guys really believe me, if they really understood, where is their giving of thanks? And Jesus is saying, this is important for our life, that as we first hear the good news of Jesus, that he died for my sins and he rose again, and there's nothing I have to do, there's nothing I can do to earn this gift. I simply repent of my sins and believe in this glorious Jesus, and I'm saved and I'm cleansed and I'm healed. And friends, if this is the reason I gave you this first point, that see yourself in the story as the leper. Because if you see how pitiful your own condition was, how broken you were, how you had no ability to fix your own brokenness, to heal yourself, to save yourself, and Jesus enters your life and he heals you and cleanses you and saves you all at the same time, then the receiving of that in faith instinctively overflows with joy. And the ability to separate out those two things. You know, if you had someone in a hospital today and somehow they had a miraculous healing from the brink of death, they would come out grateful somehow to someone, whoever they give credit to. And I want you to see this key then in the text, that as this man comes back to Jesus, falls on his face in worship, and is thanking Jesus even as he's praising God, notice Jesus' words. He says, "Rise and go your way. Your faith has made you well." But I think it's important to underline those words, "has made you well," and realize it is the original language word, "your faith has saved you." And in nearly every context in the Bible where this word sozo was used, it means God saved you, God rescued you in a spiritual inside-out sort of way. The nine went away because they were happy with their outside-in transformation, right? It was the fact that Jesus changed something that everyone else could see physically on the outside that would lead to a new inner peace. The opportunity to move on with social relationships and even worship in the synagogue and all those kinds of things. But with this one, as he comes back, he gets more than this outside-in transformation. He gets the inside-out thing, the salvation. And by the way, I want you to notice here who Jesus saves, because Luke makes the point and then Jesus makes the point that the one that Jesus saves is the Samaritan. And as his disciples are watching this and these crowds are following him, and you know they're tiptoeing along the border of Galilee and Samaria, making sure they don't set foot in Samaria because, those people, right? Those half-breed, disgusting people who have set up their own temple at Mount Gerizim, and they don't worship the God that we worship, and they don't worship him in the way that we worship or in the place that we worship, and they're the disgusting, gross people. And Luke goes to lengths to remind us the one who came back in gratitude and got the ultimate healing, he was the foreigner. He was the one that you said, he was not only the walking dead, he was the outcast of our society in multiple ways. And what a picture of grace that is, that Jesus says, I'll take not only the walking dead, but amongst the 10 walking dead, the one that you thought there's no way it's going to be that guy, Jesus says, it's that guy. So, application, let's cultivate hearts of gratitude. As American, you know, Western people, urban people, progressive people, do you think we're effusive with our praise and gratitude toward God and other people, or do you think we kind of keep that to ourselves because we're individualistic and we're kind of doing life our way and on our own? And I think most of us lean toward too little gratitude and not too much gratitude. And while I'm studying this message, I'm kind of like texting my wife this series of things that I'm really ungrateful for, and just, I don't even know if she read ahead and knew what I was studying, but she's like, you need to stop. Like, God's done a lot of wonderful things in your life, including me and our children, and just let that overflow in your heart with gratitude. But my point is, like, even in studying something like this, you can be like, oh yeah, I need to say three nice things, or, you know, we can do it in a formulaic sense, or we can do it like the leper. And I want to give you this other application because I think this is the key. Seek the giver more than the gifts. See, that one leper who's so eager not to just get on with his life and take these wonderful things that Jesus has given him and be like, yay, now I can have the life that I want, you know, spending the money from Jesus and taking this health and this life and this energy that I have from Jesus, and now I've got this vocation from Jesus, and man, I'm so blessed, and I just go live apart from Jesus with the things that came from Jesus. I think this is the key, that if I say, Jesus, all of these gifts are wonderful, I'm grateful for all the gifts, but if you took all the gifts away, I would still rejoice, because it's you that I'm after and it's you that I have, that you will never leave me or forsake me. I think the fact that we so often take the gifts from God and use them to go live the life we want to have, we have a word for that. It's called entitlement. Okay, and I know that's a dirty word in our culture, but entitled simply means I felt like I deserved that. And any of you, and I'm not asking for a show of hands, but any of you do this with God where you're praying and you're like, but God, I have done so much for you and I have given so much to the church in terms of my time and my money and my effort, and where are you? And we're saying, I not only deserve the things I have, I deserve more than what God has given to me. Like, he's given me the short end of the stick. And it's no wonder then that we proceed with ingratitude. And I don't mean to like constantly beat ourselves down, but if you just go back for a moment and take a glimpse at yourself as a leper, just a glimpse, and then focus on the cross. And then take another glimpse if you need that reminder and focus on the cross. And you say, I was rescued from all of that because of this Redeemer who loves me and gave himself for me. Y'all know what a gold digger is? And I don't mean like the Colorado Gold Rush, like confluence of Cherry Creek and Platte River. Yep, that's why Denver got founded, is there were gold diggers. The other kind of gold digger, the relational gold digger. If you don't know, a gold digger is someone whose primary interest in a relationship is material. Okay, and we often, like our culture, looks at these celebrity couples and you see this old man who just looks old, you know, and his nose has started to grow substantially and he's got wrinkles everywhere and he's chubby, and that's to put it nicely, but he's loaded. And then this super hot girl comes along and everyone's like, oh, she found her sugar daddy. You know what I'm talking about. You're like, this is church. Did he just say sugar daddy? I did, because there's a point. The point is, how often do we treat God as our sugar daddy? And our main interest in the relationship is material. That it's like, I'm going to you in prayer. And that's why I go back to my leading off question. Why do you cry out to God? What's the pattern? And sometimes in my own life, that pattern is material. Like, I'm crying out to you again, God, because I realize today I don't have this thing. I need this in my life. Could you please provide this? And it's not going to God to get God. It's going to God to get gold, to get something, to get the gift rather than the giver. And I think very often we can treat God as a sugar daddy instead of as our master and savior and Lord and Messiah and King. And we're not throwing ourselves on our face like, I am so unworthy, but I came back because you're the most beautiful, desirable person I've ever met in my life. And only you could do this. And I will get on with my life later, but there will be time for that. I want you, Jesus. And Jesus says, your faith, that exemplary faith that wants the giver more than the gifts. I mean, the title of this sermon is Digging Gold or Digging God? And I don't mean to be overfamiliar, like, are you digging God today? But you know what I mean? Like, what are we after in that relationship? Because that's the difference between the nine and the one. The nine were digging gold. The one was digging God. So how would you know if you're treating God as a master, a savior, a friend, a king, or a sugar daddy? Two simple points and I'm done. What do I do when I get the gift? Okay, there are all kinds of gifts that God has given to every one of you. Like, one is that you're alive right now, and most of you look fairly healthy. You have energy to be here worshiping God this morning, or at least coming to seek and to learn something about God, to see if maybe you might follow him one day. All of you, to some degree or another, you're wearing clothes, you have financial blessings, material things, you probably drove here in a car if you didn't walk. You have time, you have relationships, connections, you have vocation, calling, ability. And if you're just seeking those gifts, when you get them, you run off and have the life you want with them. If God to you is precious and you say, I'm thankful for all these gifts, but I treasure the giver more. You know what you do when you get those gifts? You do what this man did. You come back to Jesus with them. And you say, you know what? My money, my income, it's all yours. It's all yours. I mean, the fact that you said something about 10% somewhere in the Bible, like, does not trouble me because it's all yours. My time, it's all yours. These abilities that I have to do this or to say that or whatever, to encourage other people, it's all yours. My vocation, my job, my calling, it's all yours. And you can take them however you want them. You can use them however you want to use them. If you took them away, my love for you and my enjoyment of you would not diminish in the slightest. I don't think I'm there. I wasn't there this past week. But what an awesome goal to say, Lord, would you produce that kind of faith in me where when I get the gift, my only interest is ultimately, how can this gift be used to glorify and make much of you? The other test is, what do I do when I don't get the gift? So I've prayed and prayed and prayed for this thing. I've hoped and dreamed about how I would use this thing, and it doesn't come. And there's, what, frustration for some of you? Anxiety, like a fear of I didn't get the income this month. Like, where is it? God, are you paying attention? Complaining, criticism. These are all signs that the giver is not enough for us. So what do you do when you get it? What do you do when you don't get it? I was reading an article, it's within the last couple weeks, and I don't remember the day. Some of you will know the name Joni Erickson Tada. She was writing an article in the Gospel Coalition blog because she was celebrating the 50th anniversary of her diving accident. Okay, so this woman, 50 years ago, as a young woman with a lot of potential ahead of her, had a diving accident where she severed her spine and was paralyzed. And I mean, she's written some amazing books, and now she has this huge ministry, and part of this article was talking about how she was sitting on stage in her wheelchair speaking God's hope to thousands of people again, because she travels the country and speaks hope to thousands of people constantly. And this girl came up to her and said, Joni, do you ever think, like, none of this, look at this, none of this would have ever happened if not for your accident? And she says, I think that every day. Well, she made this statement in that article that I read. She said, I really would rather be in this wheelchair knowing Jesus as I do than be on my feet without him. See, God didn't give her the gift, but he gave her himself. And because that was enough for Joni, and by the way, I mean, read her story, okay? She went through serious depression. She's not just one of those happy-go-lucky people like, well, I severed my spine, praise Jesus. No, I mean, she went through deep depression and thoughts of suicide. And it took a long time for this to work out, but she let God work it out. And I think I'm still in the middle of God working that out with some things in my life, but I'm going to close with this prayer from George Herbert, the old Puritan poet. And it's a poem entitled Gratefulness. I printed it for you in your bulletin on the very back, or an excerpt from it. This is his prayer to God. He says, Thou that has given so much to me, give one more thing, a grateful heart. Not thankful when it pleaseth me, as if thy blessings had spare days, but such a heart whose pulse may be thy praise.